Thank you everyone for joining us. We're here to talk about a very important issue in the Middle East today. It's hard to talk actually about anything in the Middle East without mentioning Iran. The influence and reach of Iran seem to have only expanded in the region following the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now in Syria and Yemen. So with me to discuss all of this I'm going to start from farther left, Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He's the Director of the Gulf Affairs and Government Relations here at MEI. I'm sure you've all heard about the ambassador. He's had been a diplomat even before Iran's revolution. He served in Pakistan, Saudi, Oman, Lebanon, Jerusalem, and Tunis. His last overseas posting was as U.S. ambassador to Yemen, where he served until 2013. To his right is Ahmed Majidyar, a fellow and director of Iran Observed Project at MEI. If you haven't subscribed to that, you have 10 seconds to do this now. Prior to that, Ahmed worked at the American Enterprise Institute, where he co-authored two monographs on Iran. Ahmed also taught at the Naval Postgraduate School Leadership and is a frequent guest on U.S. and regional media. To my right is a good friend of mine, Aram Narguzian, but that's not the only reason he's here. He is a senior fellow at CSIS, where he extensively studies defense and strategic and military dynamics in the Middle East and North Africa. Aram is the guy to know, to text at midnight, 2 a.m., anytime. You have a question on anything you need to know about Lebanon, the Lebanese army, who's visiting, who's not, about Hezbollah, what's their strategy, what's their little tactics. I've done that many times, and I promise I won't share your cell phone number on stage, and we're live streaming. So I want this to be as engaging as possible, so I'm going to start with a broad question for the panelists. And then I'll follow up with you. But at any point you have a question, just raise your hand and I will go to you. So if we want to start broadly, and I'll start with you, Ambassador, how would you define the scope of Iranian influence now in Yemen? The same question will go to you, Ahmed, in Afghanistan, and then Aram in Lebanon.
What I would say is that Iran does not have an historic relationship with Yemen. It's a relatively recent arrival. It's a relatively recent intervention by the Iranians that really kind of came about the same time as the Arab Spring. That prior to the Arab Spring, Iran had some interest with the Houthis, with the Zaydi Shia, but it wasn't specific. It wasn't very significant, even in terms of the wars that were fought between the Houthis and the government of Yemen in the first years of the 21st century. That it wasn't a major player, but the Iranians saw opportunities in Yemen following the Arab Spring, and given the weakness of the government in Sana'a, they saw an opportunity to really become more deeply involved in the affairs there, and began at least by 2012, if not before that, began to provide military assistance, training to the Houthis, and also began an engagement, a relationship with Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had been removed from office in 2012 and was looking for opportunities to get back in, and saw the possibility of establishing a relationship with Iran as one way that he could regain his power and authority. So it's really only over the last 5 years or so that we've seen Iran come in a significant way. Obviously, the question is, what does Iran want to get out of this relationship? Where do they see it going? And I would say that there are two specific objectives that Iran might have in Yemen. One, of course, is the ability to challenge Saudi Arabia's security and stability on the Arabian Peninsula, more broadly, not only the Saudis, but more broadly with the Gulf allies. The second one, I think, and we saw this really at the end of 2016, the USS Mason, as well as an Emirati ship and a Saudi ship, were targeted in the Bab el-Mandeb. that Iran might see some utility in having the capacity to interfere with commercial shipping in the Bab el-Mandeb, the passage through the Red Sea, in the same way that they have long aspired to be able to interdict shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, and that if you can choke off those two chokeholds, that in fact you can affect the entire global economy, and that would be a good way for them to get some insurance against intervention in their own internal affairs, and to provide a balance against the international community. So they saw these objectives. They were able to take advantage of the weakness of the government in Sana'a, and they have achieved a broad objective in doing that. At the same time, they have also deepened their relationships, and as you know, the Houthis are not twelvers. They're Zaydi Shia. They're fivers, and therefore have not historically had a deep religious connection with Iran. But as part of their overall effort to deepen their relationship and their ties with the Houthis and others, the Iranians have also been proselytizing. They brought a lot of Houthis to Iran for religious training as well as military training, and there is a growing presence of Twelver Shiism in Yemen now that has deepened the sectarian tensions in the society. So we have seen again that Iran, starting from a very nominal relationship, has actually expanded quite significantly
to many dimensions.
Yeah.
Afghanistan?
Sure. So just a general overview of the Iran policy in Afghanistan. Indeed, since the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan in late 2001, the Islamic Republic has played both sides of the conflict. On the one hand, we've seen that Iran initially aided the U.S.-led coalition in toppling the Taliban regime. Iran played a positive role in the formation of the post-Taliban Afghan government at the Bonn Conference. Successive Iranian governments, the Khatami administration, the Ahmadinejad government, and also lately the Rouhani administration, they have sought to cultivate very close ties with the Kabul government, both with President Karzai government and also with the current National Unity government in Kabul. And Iran also has contributed to Afghanistan reconstruction. But at the same time, we've seen that the Islamic Revolutionary Guards and its elite Quds force have provided measured and calculated support to the Taliban to undermine the U.S.-led stabilization efforts in Afghanistan and to accelerate the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from its eastern border, and also at times to seek political concessions from the Kabul government. And based on the accounts of the U.S. military officials and Afghan officials, and also from the Afghan media, we've seen that Iran has not only provided the Taliban with weapons and financial assistance, but has also provided training on its soil to the Taliban commanders and fighters in different Iranian provinces, mostly just close to the Afghan border, like Sistan, Baluchistan, Khorasan, and other provinces. And recently, both the U.S. and Afghan officials say that Iran has deepened its ties with both, with the military commanders battling the Afghan government and the U.S.-led coalition inside Afghanistan, and also with the political leadership. Based on the Afghan media accounts that I myself have been monitoring over the past 8 or 9 years, but recently, especially over the past one year, we see that Iran has provided more sophisticated weapons to the Taliban, not just in western Afghanistan, but also in southern Afghanistan, especially in the rest of province of Helmand.
What kind of weapons?
These weapons include mostly Iranian-made rockets and IEDs. But what is also interesting recently is that Iran has also provided some Russian-made weapons. We don't know, it's not well established whether these weapons are somehow shows a collaboration between Russia and Iran to make troubles for the United States and Afghanistan, but we do know that more and more sophisticated weapons are coming. So the key question here is that why Iran is supporting the Taliban, because for those people who are not following Afghanistan very closely, it is a puzzle always, because after all, the Taliban is the ideological enemy of Iran, which is a Shiite state. Iran almost invaded Afghanistan when the Taliban was in power in Afghanistan after the Taliban massacred the Shiite Hazaras and also killed Iranian diplomats. So why support for the Taliban now? Based on the statements of the Iranian officials and also Iranian media and also accounts of the Afghan officials, we can see that Iran has different motives. First of all, it's part of the Iranian hedging strategy, which is not just limited to Iran, but also other regional powers like Russia, China, because they are not certain about the future of Afghanistan, about staying power of the United States, what will be the ultimate result of the current Afghan political system. So they are trying to play with all sides of the conflict to ensure that their interests are secured. Secondly, it's about countering the Islamic State. The emergence of ISIS is a big threat to Iran, because Iran's eastern provinces, especially Sistan and Balochistan, has long suffered low-intensity insurgency, and some of the population is vulnerable to recruitment. So that is second. And third, it's sometimes about political concessions from the Kabul government that Iran has tried but was unsuccessful to block the strategic agreement between the Obama administration and the Karzai administration. And recently, water has become one of the issues of dispute that Iran reportedly pays the Taliban to not allow the construction of some of the water dams along its border. But last but most important one, is part of the Iranian broader strategy to evict the United U.S. military from the broader region. And that's why you see that contradiction, that on the one hand, Iran wants a stable Afghanistan and free of the Taliban, but on the other hand, they support those groups that destabilize Afghanistan to hurt the United States.
Aram, Lebanon, where Iranian influence seemed to be ahead of the curve before anyone else during the war, where do you see it today, with Hezbollah being the regional military giant, if you want, that it is? How do you define Iran's interests in the country?
Iran and Lebanon have a 500-year arc. And that 500-year arc between Iran and Jabal Ahmed in the south has traditionally been a clerical one. With the advent of the Islamic Revolution, you had a shift focusing mainly on creating deterrence vis-a-vis a new area of threats that the new regime in Tehran saw. We all know this. What this has meant in practical terms, between the mid-80s, when it was the Islamic Jihad organization, and then Hezbollah until now, is the closest equivalent for Iran of a sustained security assistance program to a credible, reliable, subnational actor partner. The closest analogy that I can think of in terms of capacity building over time to tie into a national interest would be some of the strategic relationships that the U.S. has cultivated in Asia and the Middle East, countries like Japan, Korea, and certainly Israel, when you look at the broader Mediterranean in the context of the Cold War. Today, what that looks like is a organization in the form of Hezbollah that has the benefit of about 30, 35 years of uninterrupted or broadly uninterrupted military development, with only limits to that being tensions between not so much Hezbollah and any one group in Lebanon at the political level, but whether or not the Iranians and the Syrians could agree on what the scope of Iran's influence should look like, how deep it should be, and how they should accommodate Syrian interests. That's why you had the War of the Camps in the 1980s. That's why you had tension between Amal and Hezbollah. What we see now with the decline of Syria in its own morass and civil war is more breathing room for Iran to engineer the kinds of relationship it wants long-term with its ally and proxy, an organization that, for the time being, continues to serve as its primary deterrent vis-a-vis Israel, that serves as a credible and stable threat, not only to its Gulf Arab opponents, but also the mix of factions in Lebanon that not so much are weak relative to Hezbollah, although they are, but they are nowhere near as coherent on strategy, nowhere near as focused in terms of which resources to deploy, not only in the pursuit of their interests as an organization, whether it's a non-state armed group or as a representative within the broader Shiite community in Lebanon, than their competitors in Lebanon. That doesn't mean that Iran's influence in Lebanon has been complete or seamless. There are areas where they've had a very difficult time to entrench themselves. One of the assumptions in regional dynamics in the Levant is that because Hezbollah is so powerful, the main partners of the United States, such as the Lebanese Armed Forces, must be either manipulated or managed by Hezbollah and Iran. Interestingly, the Iranians have never been able to crack that nut. You know, you do have a lot of pressure from Hezbollah and Iran to try to mitigate as much as possible its autonomy, its potential ascendancy, in an arc that spans back to the foundation of the army in 45. You've had the steady incline with dips. You now have an incline from 2012 to 2017 that does threaten Hezbollah and the Iranians that support them. But that nexus between Hezbollah being the preeminent political force in Lebanon, backed by Iran, with a military capability that spans not only Lebanon but the Syrian military theater, and at the same time, a U.S.-trained and equipped Lebanese military that is multi-confessional, that includes Shiites, creates a level of complexity that the Iranians still haven't completely managed to penetrate.
Ambassador, I want to go back to you, but follow up also on what Aram was saying. Do you see Iran in Yemen trying to copy the Hezbollah model with the Houthis, and is that realistic for them? And to just, you mentioned something that Saudi felt its security was at threat. So if we want to look now, we're almost over 2 years since the war started. Was that a necessary war for the Arab coalition?
Well, certainly your first question touches on one of the key issues within Yemen, and that's debated by the Yemenis themselves, and that is what exactly is the Houthi objective in carrying out these efforts to overthrow the government of Yemen and block the political transition that was launched in 2011. There was an assumption, I think, early on that, in fact, the Houthis did see themselves as a Hezbollah-like structure inside of Yemen, not necessarily that they would control the government, but that they would certainly be autonomous in their own region, that they would be able, through their own military capabilities, to prevent the government from intervening in their internal affairs and their own affairs in the northern part of Yemen, and also that they would have if they didn't control the government, at least they would have a veto over government decisions that might or might not affect their interests. When they achieved their success in 2014, there was a question about whether or not their objectives had shifted, and that, in fact, whereas they had earlier seen themselves in this Hezbollah-like situation, that it might not have been now possible for them to actually control the government. And therefore, their ambitions grew. And so it's not entirely clear now whether or not they would be satisfied with just being in that predominant but not controlling area that Hezbollah enjoys in Beirut. In terms of the Saudis, I would have to say that certainly in our own analysis of the situation in 2014 and 15, and Mohammed Al-Yahya made the point earlier on that the Saudis had exercised significant patience from the time where the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh's forces went into Sana'a in the fall of 2014 and really took effective control of the government at that point until March of 2015 when the conflict started. The Saudis did exhibit significant patience, waiting to see what was happening, supporting the UN efforts Jamal bin Omar was mounting to try to negotiate a new agreement within the Yemeni political context before they reached the point where they decided that their security and stability were at threat. If you look at what happened in those 7 months, approximately between the fall of 2014 and March of 2015, you saw the Houthis with Iranian support engaging in a number of provocative actions, calling for military exercises near the border, significant inflow at that point of Iranian military supplies as well as IRGC and Hezbollah trainers and advisors. And with a number of statements being issued by senior Houthi leadership that was directly threatening Saudi security. So certainly we shared with the Saudis a view that, in fact, destabilizing that border region was certainly an objective that the Houthis and the Iranians had, and therefore supported the decision on the part of the Saudis to intervene. Now, as you say, 2 years later, the cost of the conflict far exceed anything that anybody expected. And once again, you're in a situation, and there was a lot of discussion earlier on about asymmetric conflict, and the fact is that the Saudis are trapped in an asymmetric conflict in Yemen, where they have not been able to achieve military success, nor have they been able to achieve enough preponderance militarily to force the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh to return to the negotiating table and come to any kind of a political agreement on how to go forward from here. So the costs have grown exponentially, certainly for the Yemeni people as well as
the humanitarian level.
The humanitarian disaster, 300,000 cases of cholera now and 17 million people in significant food shortages and malnutrition. I mean, the cost to the Yemeni people has been enormous. And the cost to Saudi Arabia has been enormous. And if you look at the situation of the missiles that have come across the border from Yemen, the fact that they've been forced to evacuate a number of cities along the border, that Najran and Jizan are basically uninhabitable because of the Houthi attacks across the border. These are not insignificant costs to Saudi Arabia as well. So the situation is quite different. My own sense is that the Saudis would welcome a political resolution. They would welcome the success of a UN initiative. But so far, neither side within the Yemeni political context has yet felt the need to reach that solution.
But that solution, if it were to happen, do you see it more likely in a deal struck with the Houthis or with Saleh?
No, I think that you need to have a deal with the Houthis. As far as I'm concerned, Ali Abdullah Saleh is the principal cause that we're in this conflict today. I would say that Ali Abdullah Saleh is more responsible for the war than the Houthis are. And I don't see that there can ever be stability in Yemen as long as Saleh is there. If Saleh is to return, then basically what you're saying is that after 6 years of sacrifice and suffering, the Yemeni people would be right back to where they started in 2011.
Ahmed, Iran seemed to have an extraordinary ability in recruiting locals and sending them to conflicts or arming them in their own countries. We're seeing a new phenomena almost with Afghanis being recruited to go fight in Aleppo. What do you, does that make sense for you in reading Iranian policy? And if you can explain it more for us.
Yeah, the recruitment of the Afghans, largely from the refugee community inside Iran. There are about 3 million Afghans living inside Iran. About 1 million of that are registered as refugees, while the other 2 million, they're either migrant workers, a small number of them, but the others are just illegal workers. So that started 5 years ago when Iran stepped up its effort to prop up the Assad regime in Syria. And over the past 5 years, Iran has recruited, indoctrinated, funded, mobilized, and deployed thousands of the Afghan Shiites, Hazaras, to fight in Syria. In Iran, they are called defenders of shrines because most of them, they are told that they would be, go to mostly Damascus area and they would defend the sacred shrines of the Shiites and Islam. But once they go, they are mostly just on the front line. As you mentioned, they have fought in Aleppo, they have fought in Homs, and recently they have been deployed also to southeastern Syria, along with Hezbollah. And we don't know the exact number of the, they are called the Fatemiyun Division, because they were first the Fatemiyun Brigade, but 2 years ago, because of the increase in their size and also operational capabilities, they were upgraded to division, and an Iranian army division has approximately between 10,000 to 20,000. So that we know at least that they are more than 10,000. And the Iranian officials say that there are about 18,000 to 20,000 Afghans fighting inside Syria. That number might be exaggerated, but even if half of that number is true, still the Fatemiyun or the Afghans make up the largest Iran-backed militia force fighting in Syria right now. And while there is a lot of a lot has been written about the role of Fatemiyun in different battles and the contribution that it has had to the violence, bloodshed, and sectarianism in Syria, not much has been written about how this could affect the security and the sectarian balance in Afghanistan and Pakistan once the Syria war is over and they come back there, because there are a lot of Afghans and Pakistani Sunnis that who have fought in Syria on the opposite sides. And now they will come back with very sectarian and poisoned sectarian beliefs, battle-hardened. So they would, of course, just fight each other in their respective countries because there are also Pakistanis deployed to Syria. They are called Zainabiyun. So the risk is obviously there. We already see the impact of that, because some of the ISIS attacks and also some of the attacks by the sectarian Pakistani groups like Jaish-e-Mohammed or Lashkar-e-Jangvi, that after they have targeted the Shiite communities in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they have mentioned in their statements that this is because of their role in Syria. So in Pakistan, sectarian violence is nothing new. It has a history of 4 decades. But Afghanistan, despite all the wars and civil wars and different wars, was largely spared of sectarian violence. So we see a new phenomenon there. And also, one thing that I'd like to add is that from my reading and monitoring of the Afghan media, of the Iranian media, especially those affiliated with the IRGC, I see that they are preparing the Fatemiyun to fight in other regional conflicts after the Syria war is over. And that's, of course, not good for the stability and the sectarian balance in the region or for the U.S. national security interests.
Aram, you mentioned that the LAF, the Lebanese army, is trying to strike this balance in Lebanon to be a force for all the Lebanese, yet, you know, perhaps have not confront Hezbollah. But you also said that Iran has expanded its influence. It has largely benefited from the Syrian war today. How much room does the LAF have to maneuver here? And how would you how do you read the U.S. or the French or the British influence on the army?
If we were having this panel in 2010, I would have been very pessimistic. It would have been an environment where USAID was recalibrating to a far more conservative level, far more focused on sustainment than lethality. The Lebanese military would have been on a path to being demoralized because not only did they have to deal with the lack of action as they saw it, or no clear strategy to deal with the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, but they didn't have a comprehensively focused response to the May 2008 clashes between Hezbollah and their political opponents in Beirut. So in 2009, you had a force that was looking for a purpose. Paradoxically, that also comes in parallel to the LAF's own gradual journey through its officer corps over time. You know, officers and personnel are like a glacier. And as that glacier moves, you see different vignettes into what's happening at a given point in time. When 2010, 2011 came around, it was about the time that the cohort of 1980, 81, 82, and other 80s cohorts of the Lebanese officer corps began to take up key posts of prominence. These were people who were trained by the U.S. in the 80s. They kept their heads down during much of the 1990s when the LAF was subordinated to the Syrian security apparatus, and coincidentally a time when Hezbollah grew exponentially. And when the Syrian civil war began, before the U.S., I have to be fair, the British identified, along with a couple of key partners within the LAF, a couple of areas where the military could stake a flag, could stake a position where it could say, we have a clear national security mandate. It isn't tied to the security politics of Israel. It does provide a net benefit in terms of stability in Lebanon and the region, and we're going to pursue it regardless of the mix of political factions that oppose it. And from that, you had the emergence of the Rapid Land Border Force. That was a very small-scale project that ballooned. It ballooned because when you see a little bit of tactical success, that creates a morale boost within the institution. It also shifted the focus within the U.S. to provide more lethal assistance and more technological capability to the LAF. A lot of this is, it does feel good if you're in the LAF to see this arc. But at the same time, all the contradictions that we talked about when it comes to Iran, not only in Lebanon, but also Afghanistan, Yemen, and other parts of the region are still there. You know, the LAF is going to act only as decisively as, number one, its leadership feels it can. This is very much a top-down force. Now, the current cadre of officers are from the 85 cohort. And the 85 cohort is basically, for me, the last of the Mohicans. These are the last guys who fought at a leadership level as junior officers in the Civil War. But it takes them time to figure out what it means to run an institution like the LAF. So you have a one-year grace period that we're in right now where they are figuring out what it means to deconflict with Hezbollah, what it means to deal with some of the legacy choices of Lebanese military and civilian leadership vis-a-vis Hezbollah and Iran. There is an intent within the current cadre to make the LAF the preeminent national security actor in Lebanon. That's their long-term vision. How to get there and how to get the mix of political forces that have held back the military over its 70-plus year arc as an institution, and how to keep the focus in places like Washington, Riyadh being a critical example of a loss of focus. The decision to withdraw military funding was a self-inflicted wound for how the Saudis projected political and military power in the Levant. It demoralized people that they'd been working with, and it made it that much easier for Hezbollah to make the case that the Saudis and other countries are not reliable partners. The edge that Hezbollah and Iran have, beyond the asymmetric edge that my colleagues have discussed, is also the ability to say we are consistent, that you have a long arc of engagement, a long arc of focus, and other countries in the region and beyond do not. And usually the casualties in these types of scenarios are these emerging institutions. In the case of Lebanon, it'd be the military.
So basically you're saying the Saudi decision of withdrawing the gift to the army, that came at the expense of Saudi influence today in Lebanon, or did it? I mean, Iran offered after that to give aid to the army, but that was not taken. So, and I mean, the U.S. still gives the army $80 million a year in aid. So, if you can be just more clear, where is Iran's and Hezbollah's influence in the army today, and the impact of the Saudi decision?
So I'll work my way in the same direction you posed that. So in terms of first the Saudi decision, all right, very much when you look at this in hindsight, we've had the hindsight of 3 years of analysis. And what you see is a Saudi that was disgruntled with a U.S. and U.K. response to the Syrian civil war and what they perceived as an unwillingness by the U.S. and the U.K. to intervene decisively in September of 2013. And a lot of these dynamics, we look at it from Washington and it doesn't make sense. Why would you withdraw support? But a lot of this has far more to do with, at the time, punishing the U.S. and the U.K. There have been concerted efforts by both Washington and London to get Riyadh to reconsider its decision.
Because the money that was going to be given was going to be, they were going to purchase U.S. And British?
There was a $3 billion tranche that was going to go solely to the French. And to the French, because of the disgruntlement with the U.S. and the U.K. In addition to that, after the August 2014 clashes between the LAF and ISIS and Nusra fighters, where the 8th Brigade hung on despite not being prepared for the fight, you had an additional tranche in the range of about $550 million from the Saudis. 90% of that was going to be for U.S.-sourced systems. The most ambitious of them would have been an acquisition path for M1, A1 main battle tanks, that sort of thing. So from the perspective of those who have been building up this arc, it was very much a self-inflicted wound. Now, on the Iranian piece, look, I've seen the list that the Iranians offered when the LAF visited Tehran. And it was a visit that they did against their better judgment because it was weighing the optics of going to Iran versus the political ramifications at home of not going to Iran. When you get a list from Iran that basically includes a mix of aging ordnance and Soviet-era systems, mortars, some rockets, and some munitions that put you in the tier of a lesser Eastern European country versus a major strategic repositioning, that doesn't translate to me as any real Iranian influence. Where it does translate is Hezbollah at the strategic level. Hezbollah and LAF don't engage at the operational level. You don't have company level or even brigade level engagement. What you have is contact at the level of military intelligence that is principally for deconfliction. When it goes wrong, it's mainly by design from Hezbollah. And it's usually because they choose the time and place where they basically take the LAF on a journey that isn't of its choosing. We had that example very recently along the UN Blue Line, where the LAF only later understood the ramifications of what was going on. You had other examples of being led by the nose, so to speak, at the tactical level in dealing with the Asir crisis in Saida in 2013, the constant risk of that in Arsal, which the LAF has so far managed to avoid, but at the expense of Hezbollah taking credit for operations that it, for example, did not conduct. So, for example, doctoring photos and video showing targeted missile strikes by Hezbollah operatives, which are clearly from a fixed-wing aircraft, which Hezbollah doesn't have.
I'll come back and ask you about Arsal and what's the photos and everything that we've seen there. But I want to go to you, Ambassador, again and ask you, how do you define U.S. interest today in Yemen? Does the U.S. have a channel with the Houthis? And another very easy question, do you think Yemen can emerge unified from this?
Easy questions. I think in terms of U.S. interests, clearly the objective is to support the U.N.-led negotiations that may resume in Kuwait, or what I'm hearing now is more likely that they would resume in Amman, Jordan, to try to work out a political path forward within the context of the GCC initiative, the outcomes of the national dialogue, and also the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 2216, in order to allow the government to go back to Sana'a, reestablish itself, continue the political negotiations in Sana'a, to come up with a new interim government, presumably replacing Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi with somebody who's acceptable, putting in a new government, hopefully with a very short-term mandate to complete the implementation of these agreements and get Yemen to a place where it can have an election and actually give the Yemeni people an opportunity to select their own leadership and move forward. The reality is that the GCC initiative is almost finished. Most of the major elements of the initiative have been implemented, and they just need to do a few more things. So if you can get the political process going again and get a limited agreement, and then also focus on addressing these humanitarian concerns that we talked about, to reopen the port at Hodeidah, to allow full shipments of food and medicines and other humanitarian goods to come into the country and get distributed without being blocked by the various armed factions. And then also taking some steps to try to stabilize the situation, get the central bank working so that you're distributing funds are getting out into the community so people have the wherewithal to buy goods. These are the basic short-term elements of a solution that can stabilize the situation in Sana'a and allow the country to come back, to move forward again. I do believe that ultimately it's in the U.S. interest as well as in the regional interest to try to preserve Yemen's territorial integrity, the concern that I would have is that if you don't retain unity within Yemen, there's no reason to believe that it would go back to the two states that it was before 1990. That in fact there are divisions even within the south, in Hadramaut, in Mahra, and elsewhere, that would not want to be part of a southern state again. And so that what you might end up with is not two states, but you might end up with three or four or five or half a dozen states, all of which would be politically insecure, economically not viable and vulnerable to the continuation of the AQ threat that we have in Yemen now. So I think that we have a strong interest in trying to retain the unity. It should be a decentralized state. And, of course, the National Dialogue addressed the idea that at the end of this process there should be a federalized state in Yemen that would provide with the Yemeni people with local autonomy and an ability to control more of their own lives at a local level. So,
would Iran accept this? Though? I mean, can they spoil it?
So, you know, in terms of the Iranians, the situation right now. If I were an Iranian bureaucrat who was tasked with writing a paper about how is Iran doing in its regional ambitions, I would have to say that Yemen would be one of the bright spots in my report. You know, that you have to look at it and say, if I were an Iranian, I'd say that we're doing pretty well in Yemen. We have, for very little cost to ourselves, we have hamstrung Saudi Arabia. We have cost Saudi Arabia enormously financially, militarily. They've been embarrassed. We've created stresses and strains between Saudi Arabia and its key partners, the U.S. and the U.K. So this is a victory for us. But the issue is, if you look at it from a slightly broader perspective, where does Iran go with this? What I would say is it depends, and I think part of the question is who's in control in Tehran. But if you have an Iran that's comfortable with the level of tension in the region right now, then continuing to press forward in Yemen makes a lot of sense. But if you have an Iranian policy that says we don't want to get into a shooting war with the United States, the best way to get into a shooting war with the United States is to continue to destabilize the region and push the Saudis and the GCC states into taking a more aggressive, hostile stance vis-a-vis Iran. So maybe it's not a bad idea for us to try to find ways to reduce tension. We saw a little bit of that in December after the GCC summit when the Kuwaitis went to Tehran carrying a letter from the GCC. We had a return visit to the Gulf by Rouhani, who went to Kuwait, and he went to Oman. Javad Zarif went to Qatar. And so there may be some interest in Tehran about finding ways to reduce tension and reduce the prospect of having a hot war with the United States. And if you were going to make that calculation, the easiest way for Iran to do that, to reduce tensions, would be to support a political resolution in Yemen. Yemen is not important to Iran in the same way, that we heard that Syria is existential for Iran. Lebanon, you have 500 years of Lebanese-Iranian relationships and the huge commitment that Iran has made to Hezbollah and to its presence in Lebanon. You don't have any of that in Yemen. And if you were to make a deal in Yemen, then from a propaganda standpoint, you would say this is a win for Iran because we can demonstrate that we're the responsible adults in the region against the Saudi nuts who are, continuing to press the conflict. And also, there's nothing that would have a greater impact in terms of the regional aspects than reducing the Yemen conflict and getting that off the table. So there may be interest. I think it's worth testing the Iranians. There may be interest. There may be some prospect or capacity for Iran to be somewhat supportive of trying to find a solution in Yemen.
Yeah. Ahmed, we keep talking about, U.S. increasing troops level in Afghanistan. We are into year 16 now of the longest war in U.S. history, recent history. So, and then you look at what Secretary of Defense Mattis said, that Russia now is aiding the Taliban. So do you see where Iran comes in and where Russia comes in? Do you see now a joint threat to U.S. presence? And if the U.S. were to increase troops in Afghanistan, can that push against Iran?
To answer the first part of your question, the United States has two vital interests in Afghanistan. And first is to make sure that Afghanistan does not descend back to chaos and instability, or the return of the Taliban, or in the worst case scenario, even a civil war, that would allow Al-Qaeda to reconstitute itself, or the ISIS, especially now that they are losing ground in Syria and Iraq, that they find a new safe haven in parts of Afghanistan. And the second vital interest is that if Afghanistan becomes unstable, that, of course, has its impact on Pakistan. So to prevent a situation that the Pakistani nuclear weapons fall into the hands of the Taliban, to the extremists inside Pakistan. I think that the Trump administration is set to announce its strategy soon, but we already know that that would include a surge of about 3,000 or 4,000 troops to Afghanistan. But that is not to defeat the Taliban, because there is now a recognition that a military victory is not possible in Afghanistan, but because the Taliban has the momentum and now controls more territory than any time in the past 16 years, to arrest their momentum and hope, it's not mostly a strategy, but hope that there would be a political settlement with the Taliban in the long run. And in that scenario, actually, the U.S., Russia, and Iran, they want the same outcome in Afghanistan, a stable Afghanistan that is not a safe haven for terrorist groups which threaten regional stability. However, the increasing tension between Iran and the United States on the one hand, and U.S. and Russia in some areas on the other hand, that plays out now in Afghanistan, because one thing that I didn't mention before is that another reason that Iran maintains close relationship with the Taliban is to send a message to Washington that if you push back against us in Syria or Iraq, we can create more trouble for you here in Afghanistan. So given this rising tension between the U.S. and Iran over the missile issue, over Syria and Iraq, or the nuclear issue, which seems to be again coming forth, I don't see a kind of like very large-scale cooperation between U.S. and Iran in Afghanistan. But what I think that they both countries, it's good for them that they do in Afghanistan, is to complement, to bring their tension from the Middle East or other issues into Afghanistan, because ultimately they share the same interest, although that's easy said and done. And about Iran and Russia, I don't see Iran and Russia as kind of strategic partner, despite the fact that they are cooperating in Syria very closely. It's more a marriage of convenience and a transactional relationship. There are very deep mistrust between Russia and Iran. So the U.S. should, I think, that engage Russia, not just Russia, but other actors like China also, to put pressure on Iran not to increase its destabilizing goal in Afghanistan.
Excellent. We will turn to audience questions. So if you have a question, we're going to go here first. Please raise your hand, introduce yourself, and I guess wait for the mic. Yes.
Hi, my name is Mohammed Tahir from Radio Free Europe Liberty. My question will go to Majid Yar, to you. There was times in the past when we seen or heard from media that money will be flown to Kabul from Iran in the shopping bags during the Karzai time. Now, then there was only one head of the state. Now, these days, there are several of them in different level. Who is the Iran's partner in Afghanistan's administration today? And the second question is, I try to recall that in 2010, I believe, I wrote a story on Iranian involvement in Afghanistan. In response to that, my president of my organization got a 5-page response from Human Rights Watch that I'm misleading world on that subject. Based on this discussion, it wasn't that misleading. So since then, 7 years passed, even if we compare that as a deadline. What is the achievements of Iran in Afghanistan, if you can explain in a PowerPoint style in few comments? Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll try to just be very brief and just talk to you about it more after the event. Regarding the first part of your question about money flowing to the presidential palace in Kabul, that was during the Karzai administration. And of course, President Karzai admitted that, and he said that the same way that I received money from the CIA or other foreign intelligence agencies or government, the same way we receive money from Iran. Of course, there was the issue of accountability, there was the issue of that what the Iranians want in return, that was a big controversy at that time. Right now, those issues don't exist, but the Iranian government has very close relationship both with President Ghani and also his National Unity Government partner, Abdullah Abdullah. But if I compare the Iranian strategy in terms of influence that you talked about, with which actors or people, to kind of a game of roulette, they will have a chip. They have a chip on each kind of number. So Iran has maintained its ties with a lot of those warlords or resistant groups that fought the Taliban. Iran has tried to influence the Afghan parliament very much to benefit Iranian interests. If you remember, when the Obama administration was negotiating the strategic partnership agreement with the Karzai administration, Iran unsuccessfully tried to bribe the parliamentarians or even later the members of the Loya Jirga, the Grand Assembly members, to dissuade the Afghans not to sign the agreement. That was not successful. We usually also talk about the Iranian, when it comes to Iranian influence, about the hard power influence. Whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's Lebanon, or whether it's Iraq or Syria, what I think that not much has been discussed is about Iranian soft power influence. And when it comes to Afghanistan, and that kind of, that soft power influence usually complement the Iranian broader objectives and even the hard power strategies. In Afghanistan, the Iranians, they have opened a lot of madrasas, that the books and even sometimes the teachers, they come from Iran. They are funding a lot of media organizations that promote anti-American propaganda and promotes Iran's political and ideological interests. Iran has maintained very close relationship with key actors in Western Afghanistan because it wants to have a buffer zone alongside its border. And Iran also has become Afghanistan's largest trading partner. And it's working with India to give access to Afghanistan to the Chabahar port to reduce Afghanistan's dependence on Pakistan, to Pakistan's Gwadar port. That kind of influence can be positive or negative because it, of course, benefits Afghanistan a lot. But if relations between U.S. and Iran deteriorates in Afghanistan, then Iran can use that leverage for its political concession. And regarding the second part of your question, that what kind of achievements Iran has had, I think that they have had mixed results for these kind of activities that they have had. Similarly, that I mentioned that they have tried very hard through different methods to convince the Afghan people, to convince the Afghan politicians, to oust the United States and to prevent the long-term presence of the U.S. forces there. But they've not been very much successful. And they're limited, or their area of influence also does not go very much beyond Western Afghanistan, although they have tried a lot in the south, east, and even north. So it is kind of a mixed result. And I think that the more that Afghanistan becomes stable, the same way that we can argue about Iraq and others, I think the Iranian influence will decrease. But again, I cannot emphasize enough that as much as we pay attention to the Iranian hard power influence, we should pay attention to the soft power influence as well, whether it's Lebanon or it's Iraq or Syria. If you read the Iranian media, they are already trying to dominate the Syrian economy, sending the Revolutionary Guards groups there. The same way that we had a lot of discussion about the PMF in Iraq, that Iran doesn't want them to be disbanded, but we also at the same time see that Iranians want them to be part of the political system in the future, to run for elections, local elections. In Lebanon, for example, we always talk about this weapons that Iran gives to Hezbollah, but we don't talk about, for example, the Imam Khomeini Relief Committee, the kind of activities that they are doing to promote Iranians' agenda there. We don't talk about the reconstruction efforts that Iran after the 2006 war, for example, implemented in Lebanon as part of supporting Hezbollah and consolidating its gains. So as much as the hard power, the Taliban or other regional factors are important, the Iranian influence and soft power influence is also growing in the region.
So we're going to get the two questions at the same time over here and the gentleman over there too.
Hi, it's Tom. I'm an intern here at MEI, and I have a question for Ambassador Fireman. So for a long time, the Houthis have been accused of receiving support from Yemen for a while by former President Saleh himself. So now that kind of puts the current situation in a bit of an ironic light. As far as I can tell, the only two groups that receive support from Iran that deny it are the Houthis and the Taliban. Why would the Houthis deny working with Iran when Hezbollah and the PMF and a lot of other Iranian proxies do?
Okay. Mm.
Is that on?
So the question that I have with respect to Taliban is my Afghan friends, they tell me that there are large sums of money that are pouring into Jalalabad and eastern Afghanistan, Saudi money, to build even bigger madrasas. And there's also lots and lots of money pouring into Pakistan, building madrasas. So I'm listening to all this, and I'm thinking, after so many years of fighting and all sides and everybody's involved and everything, it looks to me as if we're going to go back to a situation where there will be a lot of madrasas. Afghanistan is going to be ruled by the Taliban. And at some point, I don't know, God forbid, something bad may happen again. So is this where we're going? I mean, irrespective of Iranian money or Saudi money or American troops and that sort of thing.
And I just want to throw a question also to Aram on the, because it's, I think, important to mention this, the four Syrians refugees who died in detention by the Lebanese army, some gruesome, horrible photos we've seen of torture online. What's going on there? So if you can explain this, but we're going to go to the ambassador first for the question on the Houthis.
Yeah, I don't think that the Houthis, very much these days to deny their relationship with Iran. Curiously enough, when Saleh was accusing them of getting a lot of Iranian support in that 2003 to 2009 period, they actually weren't. At least we couldn't find it. We looked, but there wasn't a lot of support that was going to the Houthis at that point. There is now, and in 2014, after they moved into Sana'a, they actually signed agreements with Iran. There were regular daily flights from Tehran to Sana'a. A lot of military equipment was coming in. A lot of very obvious Iranian presence was visible in Yemen. So it's not by any stretch of the imagination secret or hidden. There is, I think, you know, for any Yemeni group, there is a pretty strong strain of xenophobia in Yemen. And so you don't want to exaggerate the role that foreigners play in your own activities. But it's not by any stretch of the imagination a secret.
Yeah, very briefly, I just mentioned, talked about the Iranian influence and activities and ties with the Taliban because the conference was about the Iranian regional role. But you're absolutely right that when it comes to the support to the Taliban that they receive from elements within the Pakistani military establishment or the madrasas or others, that's much more significant that they receive support from Iran. And as I mentioned in my opening comments, that Iran has provided measured and calculated support to the Taliban. It doesn't, for example, give the Taliban hundreds of tons of explosives to just blow up in Kabul and just topple the kill like hundreds of Afghans or topple the Kabul regime. But it has limited objectives, and for that effort is that's deriving their actions. But again, yeah, when it comes to Pakistan, of course, it's no secret that Pakistan not only just provides money to the Taliban, but also it provides a safe haven and also strategic guidance and other kind of assistance, as the US military commanders over the past one decade have been talking. And regarding your comment about that some Afghans have mentioned about the Saudi money pouring into Jalalabad, I've not seen anything in the Afghan media, or I've not heard anything from the Afghan officials about that. Jalalabad is the capital of Afghanistan, eastern Nangarhar province, and Nangarhar is now the center of the ISIS Khorasan. The ISIS had presence in six or seven Afghan provinces, but now it's been limited to one province, which is Nangarhar, and that the ISIS in Afghanistan is more a kind of rebranding of some of the Taliban splinters and also some of those groups that after the Darb-e-Azm military operations, they came from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So I don't see that kind of like connection between them with Saudi Arabia, and I haven't heard any accounts from the Afghan government or the media to that reference.
So on Arsal, right, I see things from two perspectives. One is the short-term tactical, and one is the long-term institutional. I've seen the photos, and I've seen a lot of the videos that have been circulating. The first thing I will say is that I've seen this sort of thing before. And I'd expect that if there is going to be some clarity on this, you'd have a transparent investigation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Lebanese military has tried to do, and it's very difficult to do it when you're an institution that doesn't actually have retraining downtime beyond training in the field, is to do something that very few militaries do, which is civil-military engagement within their own country. So when you think of civil-military affairs and CIMIC, you know, civil-military engagement activities, you think U.S. troops in Afghanistan. You think NATO forces in Iraq and so on. You don't think about a military doing it in its own backyard. And that's something that they're increasingly going to have to do. Again, a point that I made earlier, this is a new leadership. They have a blank slate. They're from the field. But at the same time, they're learning the hard way that there are things that can and will go wrong. How they address them is what matters.
Should the U.S. be pushing for more oversight, for more of these investigations, for when these cases actually happen, that, hey, you're not going to get a blank check from
they
Washington?
Are. I mean, my experience over the last 10 years covering the LAV is that the U.S. approach is not that different from the approach of other partners in Europe and the Middle East, which is we are going to press you hard if we think you've made a mistake. That doesn't mean that we're sacrificing the relationship on the altar of human rights. It means that we think you can do better as a partner when it comes to things like civil engagement and human rights. This is a long-term issue. For me, the short-term issue in Arsal, you know, as painful as it is to kind of brush this aside, is something that's far more pertinent to the talk about Iran and Hezbollah, which is that you have a very small window within which either Hezbollah or the Lebanese military are going to be the decisive actor in terms of shaping the security politics of Arsa. We're not talking about months anymore. This is an imminent issue. And it'll be a key test, and it'll be something that folks both in Lebanon and internationally will be watching very closely. And I will close just with one little note to tie into what Ahmed said about soft power. You know, I teach at a university in Lebanon a master's level course on strategic development in Lebanon. And one of the trends in every university is one of two things. Either a majority pool of students are now from the Shiite community, or they're quickly going to become the majority of the student pool. Shiites at Lebanese American University, AUB, St. Joseph's, are now a hallmark of how that community is transforming. I saw that transformation in the Army because fewer and fewer recruits are joining the military because more and more people have other opportunities for social mobility. And as much as Hayya Benna and the assistance from the Iranians was, from my view, a classic example of a rapid response, efficient, focused, the long game is shaping how these young, new demographic groups are educated, acculturated. And yes, there are focused efforts to do some of that by countries like Iran. But when you get to post-secondary education, I think we often find that not only the Lebanese, but also the Iranians themselves have a very difficult time finding alternative to the U.S. option in education.
Excellent. Thank you, Aram. Thank you, Ahmed. Ambassador Feierstein, I'm going to turn it over to you for closing remarks, and soon you'll be released. Thank you all for joining us in this.
We're here. Thank you, Joyce. First of all, I want to thank Senator Coons for his remarks today, for all of the panels, for all of our wonderful moderators. Also want to note the contributions of our support staff, Jessica Agostinelli, Liz Siegel, Ryan Saada, Sophia Mauro, and Scott Zuke. And most of all, I want to thank all of you, the survivors, who managed to make it through 5 hours of conversation about Iran. I do hope that it was worthwhile. I hope that we're leaving the event knowing a little bit more, having a little better insight about what Iran's strategy is, what our own policies might be, how we might address these various challenges. Thank you all very much for coming today. Thank you.